Chapter 6. Whistling and tune humming pretense of not missing anything, until one afternoon when Monsieur Mutual's patch of sunlight was in shadow, and when, according to all rule and precedent, he had no right whatever to bring his red ribbon out of doors, behold, here he was, advancing with his cap already in his hand 12 paces off. Mr. the Englishman had got as far into his usual objurgation as, what boos I, when he checked himself. Ah, it is sad, it is sad. Heelas, it is unhappy, it is sad. Thus old Monsieur Mutual, shaking his gray head. What deucin at least, I would say, what do you mean, Monsieur Mutual? Our corporal. Heelas, our dear corporal. What has happened to him? You have not heard? No. At the fire. But he was so brave, so ready. Ah, too brave, too ready. May the devil carry you away, the Englishman broke in impatiently. I beg your pardon, I mean me, I am not accustomed to speak French. Go on, will you? And a falling beam, good God! Exclaimed the Englishman. It was a private soldier who was killed? No. A corporal, the same corporal, our dear corporal. Beloved by all his comrades. The funeral ceremony was touching, penetrating. Monsieur the Englishman, your eyes fill with tears. What boos I, Monsieur the Englishman, I honor those emotions. I salute you with profound respect. I will not obtrude myself upon your noble heart. Monsieur Mutual, a gentleman in every thread of his cloudy linen, under whose wrinkled hand every grain in the quarter of an ounce of poor snuff in his poor little tin box became a gentleman's property, Monsieur Mutual passed on, with his cap in his hand. I little thought, said the Englishman, after walking for several minutes, and more than once blowing his nose, when I was looking round, that cemetery I'll go there. Straight he went there, and when he came within the gate he paused, considering whether he should ask at the lodge for some direction to the grave. But he was less than ever in a mood for asking questions, and he thought, I shall see something on it to know it by. In search of the corporal's grave he went softly on, up this walk and down that, peering in, among the crosses and hearts and columns and obelisks and tombstones, for a recently disturbed spot. It troubled him now, to think how many dead there were in the cemetery. He had not thought them a tenth part so numerous before, and after he had walked and sought for some time, he said to himself, as he struck down a new vista of tombs, I might suppose that everyone was dead but I. Not everyone. A live child was lying on the ground asleep. Truly he had found something on the corporal's grave to know it by, and the something was Babel. With such a loving will at the dead soldier's comrades worked at his resting place, that it was already a neat garden. On the green turf of the garden Babel lay sleeping, with her cheek touching it. A plain, unpainted little wooden cross was planted in the turf, and her short arm embraced this little cross, as it had many a time embraced the corporal's neck. They had put a tiny flag, the flag of France, at his head, and a laurel garland. Mr. the Englishman took off his hat, and stood for a while silent. Then, covering his head again, he bent down on one knee, and softly roused the child. Babel, my little one. Opening her eyes, on which the tears were still wet, Babel was at first frightened. But seeing who it was, she suffered him to take her in his arms, looking steadfastly at him. You must not lie here, my little one. You must come with me. No, no. I can't leave Theophile. I want the good dear Theophile. We will go and seek him, Babel. We will go, and look for him in England. We will go, and look for him at my daughter's, Babel. Shall we find him there? We shall find the best part of him there. Come with me, poor forlorn little one. Heaven is my witness, said the Englishman, in a low voice, as, before he rose, he touched the turf above the gentle corporal's breast, that I thankfully accept this trust. It was a long way for the child to have come unaided. She was soon asleep again, with her embrace transferred to the Englishman's neck. He looked at her worn shoes, and her galled feet, and her tired face, and believed that she had come there every day. He was leaving the grave with the slumbering Babel in his arms, when he stopped, looked wistfully down at it, and looked wistfully at the other graves around. "It is the innocent custom of the people," said Mr. the Englishman, with hesitation. "I think I should like to do it. No one sees." Careful not to wake the bell as he went, he repaired to the lodge, where such little tokens of remembrance were sold, and bought two wreaths. One, blue and white and glistening silver, to my friend. One of a sober red, and black and yellow, to my friend. With these he went back to the grave, and so down on one knee again. Touching the child's lips with the brighter wreath, he guided her hand to hang it on the cross, then hung his own wreath there. After all, the wreaths were not far out of keeping with the little garden. To my friend. To my friend. Mr. the Englishman took it very ill, when he looked round a street corner into the great place, carrying the bell in his arms, that old mutual should be there airing his red ribbon. He took a world of pains to dodge the worthy mutual, and devoted a surprising amount of time and trouble to skulking into his own lodging like a man pursued by justice. Safely arrived there at last, he made Babel's toilet with as accurate a remembrance as he could bring to bear upon that work of the way in which he had often seen the poor corporal make it, and having given her to eat and drink, laid her down on his own bed. Then he slipped out into the barber's shop, and after a brief interview with the barber's wife, and a brief recourse to his purse and card case, came back again with the whole of Babel's personal property in such a very little bundle, that it was quite lost under his arm. As it was irreconcilable with his whole course and character, that he should carry Babel off in state, or receive any compliments or congratulations on that feat, he devoted the next day to getting his two portmanteaus out of the house by artfulness and stealth, and to comporting himself in every particular, as if he were going to run away, except, indeed, that he paid his few debts in the town, and prepared a letter, to leave for Madame Bauclet, enclosing a sufficient sum of money in lieu of notice. A railway train would come through at midnight, and by that train he would take away Babel, to look for Theophile in England, and at his forgiven daughters. At midnight, on a moonlight night, Mr. the Englishman came creeping forth like a harmless assassin, with Babel on his breast instead of a dagger. Quiet the great place, and quiet the never-stirring streets, close the cafes, huddled together motionless their billiard balls, drowsy the guard, or sentinel on duty here and there, lulled for the time, by sleep, even the insatiate appetite of the office of town dues. Mr. the Englishman left the place behind, and left the streets behind, and left the civilian inhabited town behind, and descended down among the military works of Vauban, hemming all in. As the shadow of the first heavy arch and postern fell upon him, and was left behind, as the shadow of the second heavy arch and postern fell upon him, and was left behind, as his hollow tramp over the first drawbridge was succeeded by a gentler sound, as his hollow tramp over the second drawbridge was succeeded by a gentler sound, as he overcame the stagnant ditches one by one, and passed out where the flowing waters were, and where the moonlight, so the dark shades and the hollow sounds, and the unwholesomely locked currents of his soul, were vanquished and set free. See to it, Vaubans of your own hearts, who gird them in with triple walls and ditches, and with bolt and chain and bar and lifted bridge, raise those fortifications, and lay them level with the all-absorbing dust, before the night cometh, when no hand can work. All went prosperously, and he got into an empty carriage in the train, where he could lay Babel on the seat over against him, as on a couch, and cover her from head to foot with his mantle. He had just drawn himself up from perfecting this arrangement, and had just leaned back in his own seat contemplating it with great satisfaction, when he became aware of a curious appearance at the open carriage window, a ghostly little tin box floating up in the moonlight, and hovering there. He leaned forward, and put out his head. Down among the rails and wheels and ashes, Monsieur Mutual, red ribbon and all. Excuse me, Monsieur the Englishman, said Monsieur Mutual, holding up his box at arm's length, the carriage being so high, and he so low. But I shall reverence the little box forever, if you're so generous and will take a pinch from it at parting. Mr. the Englishman reached out of the window before complying, and without asking the old fellow what business it was of his, shook hands and said, adieu. God bless you. And, Mr. the Englishman, God bless you, cried Madame Bauclet, who was also there among the rails and wheels and ashes. And God will bless you in the happiness of the protected child now with you. And God will bless you in your own child at home. And God will bless you in your own remembrances. And this from me. He had barely time to catch a bouquet from her hand, when the train was flying through the night. Round the paper that enfolded it was bravely written, doubtless by the nephew who held the pen of an angel, homage to the friend of the friendless. Not bad people, Babel, said Mr. the Englishman, softly drawing the mantle a little from her sleeping face, that he might kiss it, though they are so, too, sentimental himself at the moment, to be able to get out that word. He added nothing but a sob, and traveled for some miles, through the moonlight, with his hand before his eyes. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.